we want to continue the discussion of nitrates. In this case, looking at it at the field scale, our next speaker, Dave Legvold, is a farmer educator from Northfield, Minnesota. He's spoken with this group before, and we're welcoming him back. He's brought along some people. He works closely with the students of St. Olaf in terms of their undergrad education in Northfield, and he's brought some of the students along. And I'd like you to give a warm welcome, please, to Dave Legvold.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to introduce the guests I have with me today. Two students from St. Olaf. Both of them are seniors. They've successfully navigated 4 years at St. Olaf College, and let's give them a hand for that. I have Maggie Exner, who will be speaking with you in just a little bit, and Angie Boone. Angie is working on a special project. She is a musician, and the touring groups from St. Olaf go off on buses and airplanes and trucks and so on. And a few years ago, the students decided that they would look at the carbon emissions of traveling. And they figured out a neat way to offset their carbon emissions by buying carbon credits from farmers who practice no-till and sequester carbon on the land. A very neat project. So Angie is here with us today kind of as an observer. I'm also privileged to have with me today Lee Dilley. Lee is an environmentally astute landowner. I rent farmland from him near the burg of Castle Rock, Minnesota. And as a farmer, I must say, it pleases me to no end to know that I have a landowner who cares about what I do when I rent his land. Today, I would like to take you on a little journey. Let's just call it the Tale of Two Rivers, the Minnesota and the Des Moines River. Now, both rivers start in Minnesota. Both of them have significant interactions with surface water and groundwater. Both are significantly affected by agriculture. Both have significant impairments. But the difference separates them in how these problems are addressed. First of all, the Minnesota, named for the land of sky blue waters. The Minnesota River begins on the western edge of the state, near the little pimple that sticks out into the Dakotas. That little pimple is where we find the town of Browns Valley situated. It is on a narrow neck of land between the southern end of Big Stone Lake and the northern end of Lake Travis. The Laurentian Divide provides a geographic separation between the Red River flowage and the Mississippi Basin, and that divide goes right through Browns Valley. It was named for Joseph R. Brown, a politician, pioneer, trader, Indian agent, and in 1867 he served in the Minnesota Territorial House of Representatives. The destination restaurant in Browns Valley is Ike's Chicken Shack. 4 stars on Facebook. Its cuisine, chicken. Deep fried. Fries or steak cut potatoes. Coleslaw, side salad. Don't expect braised chicken breast served on a bed of wild rice pilaf with cranberry jewels. No basil-infused apple cider reduction. No steamed broccoli. No organic green salad. Ike's Chicken Shack had a monkey cage right next to the restaurant. It was an old steel corn crib in which he kept 3 monkeys that he came up with somehow. The monkeys provided entertainment and diversion for his dining guests, and the monkeys enjoyed snacks fed through the walls of the corn crib. Browns Valley, median income, $26,563. Population, 589. 442 white, 117 Native American, the rest Norwegian of questionable origin. In the last 10 years, zero murders, zero rapes, one robbery. Most common first name on recent gravestones, Mary, John, Albert, Emma, William, Fred, Alice. The Minnesota River, named for the land of sky blue waters, is surrounded by colorful names that tell of its Native American and French trade heritage. Lac qui parle, the lake that talks. Pomme de Terre, Chippewa River, Rapidan, Watson Sag, Birch Coulee, Black Dog Lake. The Minnesota River flows through New Ulm, home of the Shell's Brewery. Now, the Shell's Brewery does not advertise that they find pristine streams that they can collect their beer water from running freely by the brewery. No such thing. Those springs are laced with nitrogen. It flows through Mankato, an agricultural and educational center, largest scene of the largest mass execution of Native Americans in our history. The Minnesota River and surrounding groundwater is in crisis. It's impaired with sediment and nitrogen. Sediment. Researchers have sought to prove the problem is due to background sources or bank erosion. Others have found strong correlation between sediment layers in Lake Pepin and soils of the Minnesota Valley, indicating erosion. Agriculture bears a large burden of this problem, whether erosion or increased flows due to drainage. The nutrients, particularly nitrogen, comes from agricultural sources. We know this crisis is ag-related, and yet we have ag groups that file contested case briefs to stop action and implementation of nutrient standards and TMDLs. Some groups continue to perpetuate the victimhood of Minnesota farmers. The crisis also relates to Lake Pepin. Lake Pepin should last 3,000 years. But it's predicted that in 300 years, Lake Pepin will be a wet prairie with a river running through it. The Des Moines River also starts in Minnesota. It rises out of Lake Chetek in Murray County in southwestern Minnesota. The river runs past the little town of Curie, Minnesota. Population, 223. One would think that the destination restaurant of a town that small would be the Pepsi machine bolted to the side of the grain elevator. However, Curie is the home of Lakeside Grill Hideaway. Minneapolis Tribune writes that this destination restaurant is classy, cool, and distinctive. The Des Moines flows out of Minnesota near the town of Jackson, some 65 miles south of its source. The tributary names for the Des Moines River are a little less colorful. The Skunk River, the Raccoon River, the Boone River, and Judicial Ditch 11, 13, and 18. While standing at the confluence of a mighty tributary of the Mississippi, an unknown but mighty tributary, Father Marquette asked members of his accompanying Peoria tribesmen, "Who lives up this tributary?" The Peorians looked at him, and with sour looks on their faces, they replied, "Moingona." The word meant excrement on the face. Well, the reverend Jesuit priest Marquette was reluctant to name this river Moingona. So instead, he was reminded of the holy place in France, Chapelle Des Moines. And so he took the name and called it the Des Moines River. The Des Moines is in crisis also. The river has high nitrogen. The city of Des Moines cannot use groundwater. It must use river water. The high nitrogen is due to ag sources. The ag sector, however, stepped up and owned the problem without blame. A collaborative effort under the leadership of Iowa Soybean and others began. Iowa soybean, Iowa corn, turkey, beef, dairy, wheat, hog, and 16 major co-ops, 4,000 farmers, Pioneer, Monsanto, Syngenta, Isaac Walton League, Gulf Defense Fund, Land Stewardship, Walton Foundation, Bush Foundation, and McKnight Foundation, as well as the Des Moines Public Utilities, all came together to address this nitrogen problem. They formed the Iowa On-Farm Network to help farmers do localized research on their farms to find ways to address nitrogen and other resource concerns. As the farmers' own research continued, they learned ways to grow robust crops without the likelihood of polluting groundwater. And their profitability increased. But the key was a strong collaborative that brought localized research to farmers so that they could find out what it was they were doing. Okay, now we'll go to the PowerPoint. How do I do that? When we think about nitrogen, nitrogen has several issues that we need to consider. It provides robust growth in crops, that's for sure. It has serious environmental consequences. Minnesota agriculture has a leaky system. That was brought to us by Larkin McPhee, the producer of Troubled Waters, a great little film produced here in Minnesota. An end transfer to surface and groundwater is a matter of how we manage the soil. Many people think it's how we manage nitrogen, but it's really soil management. We as farmers are proud people. These two young men were winners at the Minnesota State Fair. They gathered their 10 ears of open-pollinated corn. One was champion, the other was grand champion. The really good-looking one on the left is my father. He took the grand champion that year for his 10 ears of corn. We find that tillage has always been part of the farming picture. The idyllic scene of the farmer tilling the soil. Makes my heart go into apoplexy when I think about tilling the soil. Tilling the soil has been one of the most damaging things in our agricultural history. Jerry Hatfield of Iowa State states freely that we have lost half of the native organic matter that existed in our soils before the time of civilization began. So when you see a picture like this, where tillage has happened with the residue covered and the soil disaggregated, we find that there are issues that come along with that. One of them is serious erosion, where our soil is moved to lower places and the nutrients that the soil bears with it are also borne away. Erosion can be localized, like in this place. And we have to ask the question, who is taking care of the land? And so when we find that people say nobody cares about good soil and clean water more than farmers, or farmers are the original environmentalists, or farmers produce more by using less, Minnesota farmers are the best. Farmers have a moral obligation to feed the world. My assessment of these statements is, how can you prove this with data? You can't. It's opinion, it's feel good, it's warm, fuzzy stuff. We have to get to the nitty-gritty of what's going on our land. I spoke a moment ago about tillage. Tillage was brought to us by John Deere, who invented the steel plow. It was a great little tool. It helped us to break the prairie, helped us to raise robust crops when we needed it in our nation's history. However, at this point, we have a company. I worked for John Deere for quite a while, and John Deere sells large plows. This is the trend in moldboard plow sales in eight dealerships in southeastern Minnesota. In 2006, this eight-dealership consortium sold two plows. In 2012, you can see what they had on order. And as one farmer put it, if I buy a big plow, I ain't parking that some bitch in the woods, I'm using it. And that's true, because these are expensive tools. In some cases, John Deere can't make a big enough plow, so a Canadian company brings in 12 and 14 bottom plows that require over 450 horsepower to pull, all to turn the soil over and disaggregate it. This chart shows on the left side what happens when we plow an acre of soil. The blue bar indicates that in the first 24 hours, 1 acre of plowed soil will emit 2,269 pounds of CO2. If you do a little high school chemistry, CO2, a third of that is carbon. Carbon is the heart of our soil. It's our organic matter. If you go farther over to the right, way over on the right, the bar graph shows what happens when you use no-till, practically no carbon emissions. But these are invisible. We don't smell them, we don't see them. It just happens. But many farmers are not aware of what they do when they till the land heavily. There are alternatives. On my farm, I do something called strip tillage. Many farmers are espousing and are using cover crops, and I heartily rejoice at that. But right now, I am using dead stuff as my cover crop. I retain the residue on the top of the soil and till narrow pathways to allow the next year's crop to be planted. The device that you see there is called a soil warrior. It is a strip-till machine. The large yellow tank that you see carries fertilizer, so the fertilizer can be inserted into the soil rather than broadcast on the top. This shows you how it works. As you can see, no soil is turned over. Only a small portion of a field is prepared to grow crops. The other asset of this, as you can see in the tilled area near the pens, there are some little white particles in the soil. That's fertilizer. The fertilizer is placed in that zone. It's not broadcast on the field. But the really cool thing is, on the right and the left, you'll notice the residue. Some of that residue is from last year's soybean crop, and other parts of the residue is from the year before's corn crop. So we're retaining residue. If the residue is there, you can jolly well bet the soil is there. So we do have alternatives to tillage. The high organic matter that this promotes does hold nitrate really well. It holds other nutrients well. So my job as a farmer is to preserve my nutrients because I paid for them, and organic matter is the way that I hope to do that. The soil warrior is a costly machine, $80,000 for the machine itself, $20,000 to make the tractor go in straight lines on the surface of the earth. But this was in part paid for by a conservation stewardship program grant, which has gone away with budget cuts in our government. But this was one way that one farmer, this one, was fortunate enough to be able to purchase this conservation equipment. So we should be able to grow crops with robust growth patterns and heavy residue cover protecting the soil. However, we have places where nutrient transport comes out of the fields because we don't have appropriate buffering. And we also lose nutrient through tile water. And tile water is one of the issues that concerns me greatly. Do I use tile? Yes, I do. I use it as a way to condition the soil so that I can do less tillage. Because many farmers are forced to till their soil in order to get it to dry out. The soil needs to be of good quality. And how do I know when we have quality soil? Well, it's when I have bugs and worms and holes in it. Because soil has many different qualities. And the things that it needs to have are air, needs to have organic material, somewhere between 2 and 11%. It needs to have these things, biota, bugs, worms, all kinds of things. One of the keys to having soil that holds together is something that I call worm snot. It just holds the soil so well together. And when we plow it and work it and work it and work it and disaggregate it, it doesn't hold together very well. It also needs to have water holding capacity. The chunks of soil you see there are like a piece of chocolate cake. They'll soak up the water. Disaggregated soil is like a handful of flour. If you pour water on it, it doesn't soak it up. It erodes away. And we need to have aggregate stability. It's that magic stuff that holds the soil in place. And how does that happen? Well, it happens when farmers listen to scientists. Scientists have said less tillage helps us to build our soil. The St. Olaf nitrogen trials is something that I've been blessed with. I'm going to take you through some previous nitrogen trials, and then Maggie will get up here and talk to you about what's happening this year. We start with the Iowa N calculator, and I'm going to let Maggie explain what that is. It is a good tool for farmers. The basal stock nitrate testing is basically what you find out after this growing season is over. You cut out chunks of corn stalk and send them in for nitrate evaluation, and you can tell if you over-applied or under-applied. And you map where you take the samples, and you make sure that you're doing it scientifically accurately. Basically, you just cut out a section of the corn stalk when it reaches black layer. If you can see it in the lower left-hand corner of the photo there, there's a kernel of corn. The end of it is dark. That's when the corn has reached maturity, black layer. Cuts off the kernel from the rest of the corn plant so that it doesn't take any nitrogen out of the stalk anymore. Our averages bore out the fact that if we use best management practices and accurate rates, we get the best return. A dramatic proof picture is the picture of the corn ears with varying nitrate rates. You'll notice that the lower right has beautiful looking ears, nice long ears, big ones, but they required quite an investment of fertilizer to get there. And the results show us that the best return is if we stick pretty close to the recommended rates. The Iowa On-Farm Network, as I mentioned before, there are some places in Minnesota this happens, but it's a robust program where farmers are able to try different rates, and they do flyovers, and they do infrared photos to tell how the crop is growing, and then they bring out the yield figures. So, Maggie, it's time for 2013 St. Olaf research. This is not something I pay for. It's something that Maggie pays a lot of money to do while she's a student at St. Olaf.
Hello. As Dave said, I'm Maggie, and I've been part of an ongoing project studying the effects of nitrogen and now tillage methods on corn yields. As you can see, this is the setup of our study. Field 1 uses tillage methods the farmer describes as intermediate between conventional and conservation tillage and leaves most crop residues on the field, while Field 2 is actually farmed by Dave Legbold, who uses strip till, as you mentioned, and leaves most crop residues, even more crop residues, on the field. Both fields applied one flat rate of nitrogen and one variable rate of nitrogen, but Field 1 applied higher variable rates ranging from 80 pounds to 170 pounds, while Field 2 applied lower variable rates ranging from 0 to 94 pounds. The objectives of our study were to compare the effects of tillage methods in terms of their effects on soil characteristics, and to look at the effects of the nitrogen applications in terms of yield, soil characteristics, and nitrate levels. The soil characteristics we looked at were percent moisture, percent organic matter, bulk density, pH, ammonia, phosphates, and nitrates, but we haven't yet analyzed the last three, so our data is not yet complete. However, for the data we do have, these are our most striking results for soil characteristics. As you can see, field 2 has significantly higher percent moisture, likely due to its use of the strip-till method, and significantly higher organic matter, likely due to the fact that it leaves more crop residues on the field. These are our results for field 1 for yield and stock nitrates. Stock nitrates just refer to the amount of nitrogen that the corn stalks are actually taking up from the soil, from the amount of nitrogen that you applied. As you can see, the amount of yield was pretty constant across all treatment groups, which wasn't exactly what we were expecting. What we were expecting to see was a pretty constantly increasing yield at the beginning up until the optimal level of nitrogen. And after that point, we were expecting to see the yield still level off. However, once we looked at the stock nitrates, we got some insight into why this occurred, because all of the stock nitrates, except for the 110 treatment group, came back in the excessive range. The optimal range is marked with the dotted gray lines on the graph. And this suggests that this field applied more than the necessary amount of nitrogen. These are our results for field 2. As you can see, aside from the zero treatment plot, yield increased fairly constantly with increasing nitrogen application, which was a bit more what we were expecting, but not quite exactly what we were expecting, because even though yield did start to level off after the 79-pound application, the most profitable level was still the 94 pounds, rather than the 64 pounds, which was what was recommended by the Iowa Corn Calculator. And that is, the Iowa Corn Calculator is essentially just a tool that takes into account input costs and selling price to determine the theoretical optimal nitrogen level application. However, once again, once we looked at stock nitrates, we gained some insight into why this happened. Since all of these came back extraordinarily low, the highest was about 200 parts per million, while the lower bound of the optimal range is 700 parts per million. So we thought that this field might have lost a lot of nitrogen due to the heavy rains. And we thought that field 1 might not have experienced the same losses due to perhaps differences in topography. So in summary, the field 2, which used the strip-till method and left more crop residue on the field, had higher percent moisture and higher organic matter. Field 1 had probably applied excessive amounts of nitrogen, and field 2 likely lost a lot of nitrogen due to heavy rain. From our results, we thought that field 1 likely had greater consequences for groundwater, and our results altogether showed that it's difficult to set a single appropriate nitrogen target, that differences in topography, the weather, soil characteristics, all are going to play in, and that on-farm research can help farmers determine an appropriate level. Thanks.
A tool that I think may help farmers get a glimpse into what's going on with nitrate and groundwater is the soil lysimeter. A soil lysimeter is a tube with a semi-permeable end, and you can see it is inserted in the soil with the semi-permeable end below the root zone. So you can tell if there's nitrate that is leaching down into the deeper zones of the soil and not being used by the plant. This is a schematic. It's fairly simple. It's cheap. We could make a million of them and move them out into farmland without a whole lot of difficulty. How it works is there is a little vacuum pump. You apply a vacuum pressure to the tube and suck the water that is accumulated out into the flask, and then you analyze it for nitrate. It gives you a good glimpse of what's happening. Experimental uses, you can see on the left, There's a 200-pound rate of nitrogen in the middle, kind of a middle rate, and then the yellow is a smaller rate. If we keep an eye on this over a period of years, we can find what's happening to the nitrate. When you apply too much, what happens to it? Does it go into the root zone or does it go below? So the soil lysimeter is one of those tools that I think provides farmers with hope that they can manage nitrate in a much better way. How do we bring about change in agriculture? Well, we have the Minnesota Discovery Farms working here in our state. It's a great organization. It's supported by corn, soybean, and other organizations. It is localized, centralized research. It's scientifically defensible. It's great. The thing that concerns me is it does not speak to individual farmers. It is agency-driven, and it is farmer-driven in that we have farmers who ask questions. But is anybody coming out going through my driveway and talking to me about what's happening on my dirt in the Discovery Farms model? Answer, no. What we really need is decentralized research. Research that goes into the farmer's kitchen, sits down at the table and says, what are your resource concerns? We'd like to work with you. You'd like to research. We'd like to have people like Maggie and other college students and agency people come into the yard and say, let's go out and investigate your nitrogen without guilt and without finger pointing. Who can make this happen? Well, the federal government is not going to make it happen through farm support programs and that kind of thing. It's going to happen through collaboratives, groups outside of the normal conservation government groups. You saw this photo a little while ago. You'll note that there is a lot of surface runoff. The surface runoff is caused by soil that is sodden, and when there is even a slight rain, there is erosion. So we have soil that is not in good shape for no-till farming. The dark stripes that you see behind these two folks are tile lines that have been inserted. And in one of the things that you'll notice in my resume, I said tiling. Damned if you do it wrong. Damned if you do it right. I'll try to enlighten you in just a moment. Tile water can be disposed of in several ways. The most convenient is to dump it in the nearest township or county ditch or connect it to the nearest stream and let it go. However, we need to be thinking about what we do with tile water. There is a system that we have available to us called drainage water management. If you put tile in the ground, generally about 3 feet down, that's where the water table is. The water runs to the tile and goes out. But now we have opportunities to insert technology where we can do this with the water level. You'll notice that the tractor is sitting on top of a place where the water level has been lowered so that the tractor doesn't become mired in the soil. We assume that's planting. The crop then grows. We raise the water level so that it's accessible to the crop roots, and it is used. Usually during the months of May, June, July, and August. And those are the months when the greatest nitrate loss to tile water is experienced. So if we can hold the water in the soil and make it available to the crop, that is a much better use of that water. Then in the fall, when it's time to harvest, you lower the water table again, bring the combine out, harvest, and then you put in practices to raise the water level and hold the water back. For every inch of water that we hold in the soil, we hold about 27,000 gallons per acre. That's a lot of water, especially if it bears nitrate. So how does it work? It's this little structure, and I'm hoping this has a red pointer. Does this have an upper one? Okay. You'll notice that this structure, which is an aluminum box, is able to hold the water at a particular level and make it spill over and then be discharged. These blocks or logs are little dams, hence damned if you do it right or damned if you do it wrong. They can be pulled up so that the water has a direct discharge in time of planting and in time of harvesting. I have a little video clip. I'm just going to call it the Lost Watch. If you look carefully, you'll see what I mean. But this shows a view down into that tile water regulation structure, and you can see a little bit better how it works.
You have a trap down there for all these rocks.
Well, the downhill cell phone.
Okay, who's the skinniest one?
Yeah. Well, I don't think this tool is going to do it.
Beer bottles down there.
Now the water is flowing from the uphill side to the downhill side.
Anybody got a coat hanger?
Wow.
Those devices are a part of a program that farmers can apply for called EQIP. And the devices are not terribly expensive, but you do need to have a certified design technician put together the plan for how that works. So that is controlled water drainage, allows us to hold a great deal more water and nutrient in the soil. Those things can be placed in several places in a field, as you see here, and then the tile water needs to be put in infiltration areas with robust semi-aquatic plants that will pick up the nutrient and allow the water to infiltrate. There are also surge basins like this where they can hold the water. Many of those structures have been built in the flatter part of our state to hold tile water. There's another technique that we can use called the wood chip bioreactor, in which tile water is forced through a trench filled with wood chips. The wood chips gas off the nitrogen, and the water is sent on its way with about five times less nitrogen. And so the wood chip bioreactor is cheap, and it lasts a long time, and it doesn't take up a lot of land. But it is only useful in places where farmers are willing to implement these extra measures. So how do we value good groundwater in agriculture? I struggled with how do we value groundwater with agriculture. And I think basically it equates to the value of groundwater must be equated to the value to the farmer. And so we find that we have well water. A farmer who has livestock values good well water. We find that fertilizer efficiency relates to less groundwater pollution. And we find that there's a better bottom line for farmers if they use their fertilizer effectively. The learning curve on-farm research promotes producers learning new practices. It also gives us a chance to look at the state initiatives and learn from them in other states. Iowa has a robust reduction strategy in place. Minnesota is also working on that, but we find that it hasn't hit the farm gate just yet. We also find that as government programs shrink, we're going to have more non-governmental assistance through collaboratives that we mentioned before. So with that, I'll quit and see if there are any questions that you have.
Moldboard irrigation, because I grew up in South Dakota and we parked those plows in the tree row back in the 80s.
Yes.
It's been no-till ever since and nobody ever looked back. So why do they do that here in Minnesota?
That's a really, really hard question. I have soils that range from sandy to very, very heavy. And strip till works for me, and residue retention works for me. I believe that there is some, kind of a hysteria about BT corn because the stalks are so much healthier and so much tougher. We have to get out and shred the residue. We have to plow the residue under because we won't grow good corn if we don't. I believe that by plowing and plowing and plowing, we're depleting the soil's organic matter. South Dakota, interestingly enough, has become a net carbon sink as a whole state. Minnesota has become a net carbon emitter because of the amount of tillage. If you drive Interstate 90 or the southeastern corner, you will see that there's an awful lot of black soil. And I think it might be a cultural thing. Some farmers are afraid of the coffee shop rubdown. Why don't you have your cropland plowed yet?
I was just wondering if the no-till allows you to use less or no Roundup than if you were tilling in a conventional manner.
Great, great question. I'm a pretty religious rotator, and I have found that when I rotate from corn to soybeans, that heavy cover that the last corn crop leaves suppresses weeds in a marvelous manner. So there are some times when I can plant without having to use Roundup. However, in season, weeds are one of nature's wonderful things. They will find you, they will come back, and they will get you. Roundup is an effective tool, but we're finding that Roundup isn't the silver bullet that we all thought it would be. You have to change things up. It's like having a baby. You don't feed it applesauce. Sometimes it's peach, sometimes it's pear, sometimes it's shredded meat. Change things up for the weeds, too.
I'd like to go back to your I-90 analogy. What's different between the south side of the state line and the north side insofar as attitudes toward addressing a common problem? Why isn't that happening here in Minnesota?
Thank you. In my opinion, I think in my opinion, I'm going to be blunt. We lack a really effective cheerleader within our state. I think our University of Minnesota and Department of Agriculture has been gifted with a generous dose of cowardice because much of their funding for research and much of their support comes from commodity groups, and that's a pretty powerful thing. I don't say that they're bad people. I just say that we have to look at where's our leadership taking us. We have to look at what important people like Don Ballone, the state NRCS conservationist, is saying, all of this plowing is not good for us. Warren Formo of the Minnesota Ag Water Resources Coalition has said farmers are doing heavy tillage without understanding the science behind it. And so how do we get that message into farmers' minds so that they practice it? But there is a definite difference going from one side of the border to the other. You'll notice that there's a lot more no-till, a lot more conservation, a lot more cover crops in Iowa. And I don't know how you get at it. I'm old Norwegian. I'm close to death. And it's a problem I don't think I'll be able to solve. Does Iowa have the cheerleaders? Yes, Iowa has the cheerleaders. And the cheerleaders happen to be the collaborative that I mentioned. They do have mechanisms in place, like the on-farm network. They also have CEMSA, Certified Environmental Management Systems for Agriculture. They have lots of mechanisms that go out and talk to farmers about their practices and encourage them to experiment, and they supply the research to go along with it.
You mentioned the EQIP program for controlling water level in tiles. Is that a state or federal program?
I think EQIP is a... Is that federal? Yeah, it's something that a farmer goes in and applies for, and it won't pay for the whole system, but it will pay for part of it, and it's good support. I've had some farmers who have said, I don't want to do that because it's too much red tape, too much sitting in an office talking to technicians. But EQIP is definitely worth going after.
Other questions? I did have, actually, I was wondering, and this again is just a statistic that I had come across that your candid comments on, was the average age of farmers in Minnesota currently is what?
A lot of them are old, Norwegian, and close to death. Yeah, the average age of farmers, I think, has a lot to do with well, attitude. And changing the attitudes is really hard. It's like when you commit to buy a $60,000 or $70,000 plow, it's going to get used because that's a safe tool. You know that tillage worked for decades in the past, and it'll work in the future, but it does not do wonders for our soil. It depletes our soil. So I think age and culture is something we have to take a look at too. Thank goodness there are young people who are interested in farming and who are going to college and becoming well educated about what really is farming and how do you care for the soil. That's a good thing.
I like your eye. Oh, sorry. I got the mic. Come on. I like your idea about the collaboratives, and part of the issue here, of course, is we're dealing with managers that are private owners. And have you had any success in Iowa or Minnesota that you've observed where the collaboratives have spread across multiple farms in a watershed or over one aquifer where we can actually see some progress in a bigger scale than at the farm scale?
I think your question has to do with, have you seen any success with large farm endeavors? And the answer is yes, particularly in Iowa. In Minnesota, we don't seem to have the contact with those organizations to get them to take a hard look at it. But when the operators are less than 30, then I think we have a much better chance. And I've seen some of that happen, where the young people are cognizant of soil quality and knowing that nitrogen escapes willingly and goes into the groundwater, and we can't buy the stuff and then give it to the city of Park Rapids to deal with. We just can't be doing that.
David, I'm struck by, it sounds like you've gone through a journey here yourself, a period of
learning in your farming. And it seems like this is a very personal thing. You speak about it in a very personal way, and we're asking others to sort of go through that same personal journey. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your own journey through this. And I don't know this, but I'm assuming you haven't always done it this way, or you've changed over time. Could you speak about that?
You're right. Thank you. That's a very probing question. I really started out as an organic farmer. I wanted to farm organically and take care of the earth and all of that. But I knew that organic farmers who wanted to produce hay and small grains and soybeans and corn needed to do a lot of tillage. And I saw a lot of my soil washing away as I cultivated my corn 4 and 5 times. It was always loose. It washed away. And I thought, this can't be. So I began to move away from organics toward, and I thank a St. Olaf student of a couple of years ago who branded me as a biological farmer. You're not mechanical. You're not chemical. You're not organic. You're biological. Because I think about that sort of thing. And you're right. It's a journey. And there have been some interesting times. For example, when I worked for John Deere, people would come to me and say, well, Dave, it's spring. Are you ready to go out and do some of that lazy till? And it kind of gets you. But you continue onward. And I'm finding that through the research aspect of what's going on the farm, and I do farm St. Olaf's farmland, so they're out there looking at me. We're finding that the soil quality and other issues reinforce what I'm doing, even though it's not popular. And I have landowners like Lee who say, yeah, it's kind of weird, but it's okay. I like it. So the journey has taken me a long time. And once again, I'm really irritated that I'm old Norwegian and close to death because I think there's a lot more learning ahead of me, maybe 40 more years worth. And so that journey needs to continue. But how do we get other people involved in that journey? I think Maggie's work has brought along another farmer, Mike, who now will look at his nitrate stuff. He is beginning the journey. And so a very perceptive question. Thank you for that. Maybe our cheerleader needs to start people on, hey, a travel agent.
Talking to like a personal level to individual farmers, but and if you need a coalition, who should be the leader of that coalition? You always need a leader. So what organization or how you see that leadership would happen?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the best ways is farmers talking to farmers. And so we need to have experienced conservationists talking to emerging conservationists and move things ahead that way. And there are some people who are just not interested in it. And we'll wait for them. Thank you for that question, too.